arrangement. Let me do one remark I may forget. Today, after Topos in France,
hello, how are you?
We go to lunch with our and starting at 2. However, starting tomorrow, we shift it, and after lunch, so we'll start to 10, just to give you time. We can respect you before, and it is exactly worse time, so better to be more online. But today, it will start at 2, as was planned before.
Okay, thanks. So the aim of this lecture is to present two rather nice and powerful methods to prove functional inequalities, and I'll try to show how they operate on some problem related to convolution inequalities. So the two methods are, on one side, rearrangement, which is an old tool, maybe going back to Steiner. And the other one is monotone transportation, about which you know a little by now, I think, a lot even. And so this one is considered more modern, although if you really try to find the ideas, some of them were already in the works of Brun and Minkowski. Okay, so let me start with defining rearrangement. This is very basic. So we start with a function f of n variables, and let's say with non-negative values, and we're interested in a new function f star, also defined on Rn non-negative values, and we want f star to be depending only on the radius and decreasing in the radius. So this is a Euclidean norm. Okay, so phi is decreasing, and we want f star to be equimeasurable to f, or having the same distribution. So this means that for every t, we want that the volume, so now the bars are volume, of the set x in Rn, for which f is bigger than t, is the same as for f star. So the way to construct this, if you want to look at this on graphs, would be just to take level sets of the original function and build a new graph by replacing each level set here by a Euclidean ball that hyperplane center at the origin and having the same volume. Okay, so you would get something like this, which is a rotation invariant. Okay, so this is F star. And of course, being less spread on the space, F star enjoys somehow better properties. And the ones I will look at are related to integrals of product. So the first and very, very basic inequality you have in this case is that if you take two such functions, then the integral of the product is less than the integral of the product of the rearranged. So this is something that appears in many textbooks, usually with series, and it's well known that if you want to increase this, you would better multiply the big terms with the big terms and the small terms with the small terms. Okay. Something more interesting is Ries rearrangement inequality, 1933, which is related somehow to convolution, which tells you in the same setting that the integral on R2n of f of x, g of y minus x, h of y, dx dy, is no more than the same thing with the rearranged functions. Well, it's okay. Okay, dx dy. Is it? Okay. And there is a very nice illustration of what's in this inequality, which is related to physics, So imagine you have a distribution of mass, so a certain amount of iron, of copper, of whatever, and you want to build a planet from it, then this inequality tells you how you have to put the matter so that it's more stable. So the gravitational energy, if you have a distribution rho of x, which tells you the density of matter at x, the gravitational energy would be minus double integral of rho x, rho y over x minus y, dx dy. And when you apply the rearrangement inequality, this function here, the 1 over norm being already rearranged, you get that this is so more because of the minus. Okay, so you recover something well known that you have to build a planet on circles and putting the heavy things in the middle. Okay. So this is a rather nice application. And now I'd like to present somehow the best known result in this direction, which is due to Braskamp, Lieb, and Luttinger in 1974, I guess. So now there are many functions. Okay. So Braskamp, Lieb, Luttinger states the following. So you will have k vectors in Rn, and k functions of m variables, so f1 up to fk, from Rm to R plus. And then you have the following inequality, that the integral over R n m of dn x1 dn x, so this is k m now, of the product of k functions I equals 1 to k of fi of, so x1 ai up to xm AI. So you have always the same vector here, and you take the scalar product with vectors in Rn. Okay, so this quantity is less than the same. Okay, same with stars. Okay, did I put it right? Yes. So that might look slightly different from the Ruse inequality, but actually it completely contains it. In between, I switched notation for purpose that will be clear in the following. But if you consider that your vectors x1, xm, put like this, are actually the columns of a matrix for which you call yi the rows, then this expression here will become something like fi of sum of a I k, now these are scalars, times y k. Okay, and these are vectors. So this completely contains the Ries inequality in this form. Okay. So now, very well, briefly, I'd like to give a hint of what's contained in the proof of this. I mean, how it comes. And before this, let me remind you very briefly so basic fact that we will use. The first one is the famous Brun-Minkowski inequality written in multiplicative form. So given two sets in Rn, you know that the volume of somehow convex combination is bounded below by the geometric mean of the volumes. And the second point is a functional version of it. We won't use it now, but somehow in the rest of the lecture, something similar will occur, so just remember. And a corollary that we need for proving the rearrangement inequality is the following. If you consider a convex set and look at the parallel section function, okay, so you move x and you look at the volume of the section over x, so this is a log-concave function of X on its subroot, at least. So in particular, if the convex set is symmetric, which is not clear on this picture, if the convex set is symmetric, you have a log Conway function which is even, and then it has to be maximum and zero. So if there is a center of symmetry among parallel sections, the largest one is the one through the center of symmetry. Okay, so now we know enough to not to do the whole proof, but to, well, to understand the point, which is really important, which is really the crux of the matter. So actually, it's enough. Well, one can reduce to considering functions just of one variable here. So you would have just one variable of integration here, and fi would be evaluated on one scalar product. And you can reduce, well, this is not too difficult, to just characteristic function of sets. Okay. And what you're doing here is that you're, of intervals. So you're... Okay, so this is very simple. Here is the origin. The characteristic function is like this, and the rearranged one is when you move the center of the interval to be exactly of the origin, and what you do is you add a parameter t here, which corresponds to moving, so at t equals to 0 it's here, and corresponds to moving your interval to the actual position where it is at time 1. Okay. So the idea is that somehow you interpolate between the two terms. Okay. So for t equal 1 we recover the initial integral, and for t equals to 0 we get the one with the stars somehow. And if you express the volume of the integral with the t's, it looks like this, and then this expression can be interpreted as the volume of a section of a symmetric convex set. Okay, so the convex set is defined here. It's defined as an intersection of slabs, and it's symmetric. Okay, and when you move the parameter t, you are looking at the section above U. So it's exactly the previous picture I draw, and from this you know that the biggest section, so the largest value of the integral with the t's, will be for t equals to 0, which corresponds to the slice through the origin. Okay, so let me also state a few applications of the rearrangement inequalities. I mean, there are probably many more. I just put a few ones that I know and which are related to a little to convex geometry somehow. So the first one of the first applications, and the one I will discuss, is the Brass-Kemp-Leib inequalities, and so I'll come back to this, and there are some further results, so I can let you read, but this inequality is already rather strong if you use it with a good parameters somehow. Okay. I can stop this. So now let me introduce a second tool. Let me recall about the second tool. It seems very much related to the previous talk by Jan Brunier. So the second tool will be monotone transportation. So I'll just state the result not in the most general form, but just for what I need. So it's due to Brunier, 1997, and refined. I mean, by McCann, removed. Get a more general result without hypothesis. 95. So let me consider two measures with density, so d mu x equal f of x dx, and d nu y equal j of y dy. So I will assume that there are probability measures. So on Rn. And the theorem asserts that there exists a convex function, psi, such that its gradient, which I will denote by T, transports the measure mu onto the measure nu, satisfies so T mu equals nu. And this means that for every Borel set in Rn, you have that the measure for mu is equal to the measure for mu of the preimage by T. Okay. So in one dimension, such a map is easily built. Let me just draw a picture. So in dimension one, what you would do is define the map T so that X, so this is a density F, and then you have the density J. You send X to a point T of X such that the mass here is equal to the mass here, and this will ensure that it's true for every Borel set. So just setting integral from minus infinity to x of f equals integral minus infinity to t of x of j, you get your transport, you get your increasing transport. And so it becomes more interesting in higher dimension. So in dimension two, there is now much more choice to transport one density onto the other. One thing you can do, and which was done by Knott, 77, well, not sure, is somehow to iterate this procedure again along coordinates. So you would start by looking at a one-dimensional marginal, transport it, and then transport the conditional density, and so on. So this gives a triangular transport. Okay. And okay, actually the Brunier theorem gives something which is in some sense more natural, which is somehow I think the right generalization of increasing, which is gradient of convex. But the T equal grad phi is not obtained in an explicit manner, but it's obtained as solution of an optimization problem. Okay. So let me just recall that you find T by looking at the infimum over all S, which are maps transporting mu to nu, of some quadratic cost function, so integral over Rn, of the distance between S and S of X square d mu of X. Okay, so this is how it's built somehow. And all I will need in applications are the properties inherited from this and the infinitesimal version or infinitesimal expression of the transport, which is just a differential equation, so the Monge-Ampère type equation, which will be that almost everywhere you have that a change of variable formula somehow, f of x is equal to gj t of x times the determinant of the differential of x. Okay. So this is a variation matrix of a convex function, so it's non-negative, and I don't need to put absolute values. Okay. So this is what will be useful in practice. Okay. So now we know the methods, and let me state the theorem that I want to show you how to prove by the two different tools. So these are the Brass-Kemp-Leib inequalities. So what we need is, so we have M larger than N, N is a dimension, and we have M vectors A1 up to AM, And the statement is, okay, so we also have numbers P1 up to PM greater than 1. Okay. The statement is that you can compute the norm of some multilinear operator between LP spaces just by looking at Gaussian functions. So more precisely, the quantity you look is a supremum over functions fi in LPI of R of the following integral over Rn. So you take the product of the functions and you evaluate them on the scalar product with the vectors here. Okay. And you divide by the product of the LP norms. Okay, so this is a quantity you look at, and the theorem states that this is equal to the supremum of the same thing, but just you just have to test functions of the form gi of t equal x e to the minus lambda I t square. So you just have to look at centered Gaussian functions. Okay, and since it's homogeneous, you don't even have to put a constant in front of it. Okay. So this is the main theorem. And okay, so it's a quite a fundamental result. And before giving applications, I would like just to show you one step in their argument, and it's quite an amazing proof, I must say. So what is clear is that when you want to evaluate the supremum from the rearrangement inequality before, you know that, well, you can just restrict to the stars, okay, because they have same LP norm and this quantity increases. But doing this, you just go from a general function to a symmetric decreasing one, but this can be still very different from Gaussian. And the very nice idea to reach Gaussians is to increase dimension. And to take an increasing number of copies somehow of these integrals here and rearrange only after doing this doubling or multiplying argument. So let me write just a few lines about that. So I'm just talking about the numerator, but the denominator is much easier. So the integral over Rn of the product of Fi I equal 1 to m of Ai x, you would write as the kth root, okay, of the integral over dx1, a vector of n coordinates, dxk n coordinates, of product I equals 1 to m, of product j equals 1 to k, of fi of ai dot xj. Okay? So the fact that this is an equality is just Fubini theorem. And now you have your new function here, which you will call f capital fi of. Okay. And it's exactly of the shape we had in the rearrangement statement. And this one you will rearrange and say that the integral increases. Okay. And the rest of the proof is very surprising, because what they will do in high dimension is say basically that this function here, which is rotation invariant and decreasing, you can approximate by sum of characteristic functions of balls, which is believable. And then for each of these characteristic functions of ball, you will make a comparison with the Gaussian. So this seems to be a very loose argument, okay, because you will just say that this is somehow smaller than this, and that, well, the LP norm of this one is not too much smaller than this one. You get inequalities. There is a big error term, but the big error term will be destroyed, absorbed by the kth root here. So it seems it will never work till the last line, and then it works. it's a very nice argument. Okay. So I'd like to present a few applications. Yeah.
Flash dimension.
Sure.
This is
yes. Yeah, the philosophy. Yeah, yeah. So all functions look like Gaussian somehow, provided they're symmetric. Okay. So I think I don't really have time to enter into details, but I will just state a few results. So the main purpose of developing this inequality was to prove Young's convolution inequality. Inequality with sharp constant. So this was done independently by Bechner and Braskem-Plibb. Okay, so the classical inequality provided you have the good relation between PQR is this. And okay, this could only be inequality if the constant function was in LP or LQ, and so in is a better constant here, strictly less than one, and which is saturated by Gaussian functions. So this was somehow the first application of this, and the way I learned about this was through Kiesboll's work, who somehow made the connection between these inequalities and problems in convexity, in convex geometry. And I just like to... I'm sorry, I'm switching all the time. Maybe you can leave the light. Well, it's a little... Okay, so the first half of the slide you needn't read in detail. It's a statement of the Braskem-Plibb inequality under some additional assumption that makes it easy to calculate what's the best constant. So the best constant here is 1, and everything is fine. And, okay, the condition means the UI tensor UI is the projection onto the line spanned by UI. And, okay, this means that the vectors behave more or less like an orthonormal basis, except that there are too many of them. Okay, so but they cannot be in a hyperplane, for example. And the kind of applications Kiesboll got from this are sharp volume estimates. I'm just giving the idea. If you apply such an inequality with just characteristic functions of intervals, and you interpret this integral here, you will see that it's the volume of an intersection of slabs. Okay, so to each coordinate corresponds the color, and it tells you that if, of course, the vectors are not too much parallel, then the volume of the intersection cannot be too big. Okay. So, okay, for 2 weeks ago, Kiesboll gave a very nice lecture on an application to extreme problem in convex geometry, like volume ratio estimates or reverse isoperimetric inequalities. So, for those of you who missed it, I think that it's still available on the web. So, I advise it. And so guided by the ideas of convex geometry, Kiesboll conjectured a reverse inequality. Okay, I think that the point is that a polytope like this you can describe like intersection of slabs or like convexal of points, which is a dual point of view. And so the idea would be that if the vectors are not too much parallel, then the volume of the convex hull cannot be too small. Okay. So the conjecture inequality was something like that, where you integrate some function which is a supremum over possible decompositions of a vector as combinations of the UI. So here you see that it's really related to convex hull. You really look at the way you can write X in terms of your vertices somehow. Okay, and this like the Prekopa-Lendler inequality, which I just stated in a slide. Okay. And so now let me just emphasize that we are somehow reaching a limit of the rearrangement method in two ways. First, so proving. I could do it myself. Proving the reverse inequality. So proving the reverse inequality by rearrangement. Seems very difficult. I mean, you could conjecture that such a quantity goes down when you symmetrize. It's rather easy to check this when the FIs are a characteristic function of sets. But now, because of the supremum, you lose the multilinearity, and there are many tricks you can't do anymore. And even if you had such a rearrangement inequality, I don't think it would be easy to carry out the proof. And the other limit of the method was that somehow it was not possible to address a more general question about the Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality, which would be now that you would consider functions not only of one variable, but defined on some n variables and evaluated on some linear image of x. So you would like something like this, an fi defined on R and I. Okay, and it's rather easy to construct counterexamples for the rearrangement inequalities when the functions here don't live on the same spaces or on spaces of different sizes. Okay, so somehow you cannot do better here. Okay. Actually, Leib was able to prove the multidimensional analog of the Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality by different methods. I mean, it's a rather long proof, but conceptually it's not too complicated. Although it's difficult. What he does is that he studies operators between LP spaces that have a Gaussian kernel, and show that the norm is achieved on Gaussian functions. And then you have to go from Gaussian kernels to multi-dimensional operators where the Gaussian kernel is not really appearing in the formula, but it's there because you just integrate on some subspace somehow. And so what I'd like to do in the end of the talk is just show you how the ideas of transportation allow to give a simple proof of the reverse inequality of the Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality in full generality. And so this somehow was made possible by the analogy between the inequality I showed you and the Prekopa-Lendler inequality. The Prekopa-Lendler inequality had some proofs using transportation in one variable or using the Knotte map. So the names of the people who did that were probably Einstock, MacBase, Knotte, and then later McCann also in his thesis used Brownian map. So let me give you the full statement and try to go into the argument. Okay. So now M will be the number of functions, and N is the size of the space on which we integrate. I rewrite... this time I don't write LP norms, but I prefer to put the power on the function in the left-hand side. So the CIs are like the 1 over PIs of before. Now you have M functions, and each of them is living on RNI, and you have a linear map, BI, which is going from RNI, and it is onto... Sorry, it's on RN, and it's onto RNI. Okay. And so... let me just define this strange number here, D. It's not very important what it is for the moment. Maybe it's just an occasion to tell the definition. So BI star is just the adjoint. And the infimum is taken on symmetric positive matrices of size Ni. Okay. So the general Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality, I rewrote way using this DI, so it tells you that this quantity is bounded by some constant times the product of integrals to the CI, and it's saturated by Gaussian functions, so somehow D is related to the maximum of this. And the reverse inequality is of the same kind. So now you are on Rn, you, for each x, you look at all the decompositions as x as a sum of somehow xi's, but now you use the adjoint to inject these elements of Rni into the whole Rn, and then you take the product. And the statement is that this is bigger than the product of integrals, and again, the inequality is sharp for Gaussian functions. I mean, this need not mean that there are Gaussian minimizers, but I mean, there is at least a sequence minimizing up to epsilon. Okay. So, I still have a little time to try and give a sketch of the proof. So the main lemma is the following. So we take functions fi and capital fi of Rni with values in R plus, and it's convenient to take them with the same integral or even with integral 1. This doesn't matter because of homogeneity. And then the statement is that you have that the integral of the Brass-Kemp-Leib term somehow, product ci bix x, so divided by 1, which is exactly the product of the integral to the ci, is less than d times the integral of the reverse Brass-Kemp-Leib type term, supremum over all decompositions, blah, blah, blah. And again, you can think of it as normalized by product of integrals. Okay. So the strong point in this lemma is that there is absolutely no relation between small f and capital F, except that they have same integrals. Okay. So what you can do afterwards is say, if you want to prove a Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality, you write this and you optimize on all the FIs you can take. And if you're lucky enough, then you will get something sharp. Okay. And similarly, you can, when you want to do the reverse Brass-Kemp-Leib inequality, you can fix a capital FI and optimize on this term. Okay. And it turns out that it's somehow enough to optimize just on Gaussian terms. So if you take somehow the supremum of this on Gaussian functions, centered Gaussian functions, and the infimum of this quantity on Gaussian functions, so these two quantities turn out to coincide. So this is not in a lemma. In the lemma, it's some calculation you have to do. But it really tells you that the inequalities you can read from this are optimal and are saturated for Gaussian. Okay. So now let me go into the proof. Should I push the button? Okay. So now we're using monotone transportation, and I think it's the moment to emphasize one advantage of transportation, that you can go from any function to any function, which was not the case of rearrangement, and this gives you a lot of freedom. So here you take the optimal Brownian map from the probability with density small fi to the one with density capital fi. So the theorem ensures that this map exists, although it's not explicit, as I told. And what we'll use of this is the fact that we have this change of variable formula here. And the idea is, well, like in previous arguments for Prokopa inequality, is to build from this change of variables between the small and the capital Fi's, to build some good change of variable for the whole integral, okay, for this whole integral here. So a rather natural way to do, given the fact that you have such decompositions, is to try and combine the maps Ti in this way. So you define theta of y, which is some Ci Bi star of Ti at Bi y. So Ti is defined on R and I, so it's natural to apply it to this. And then since you want to perform the change of variable, you have to calculate the differential and its determinant. So the first thing, when you do the calculation, there's a, well, something very nice happening, is that it's exactly of the same form as the infimum that was defining the constant d. Okay, and this is due to the fact that in the definition of d, we were optimizing on matrices AI, which were size NI and symmetric positive. Okay, this was corresponding, in fact, to the calculation of these functions over Gaussian functions, and Gaussian functions are exactly e to the minus AI XX, where AI is positive. And here, we really need the fact that Ti is a gradient of a convex function, so its differential matrix is a positive symmetric matrix. So this is really where things match. Okay. So for the proof, we assume that D is positive, otherwise there is nothing to prove. And if D is positive, you get that the determinant of the change of variable is strictly positive. And since it's of this form, means it's also the gradient of a convex function, this ensures that it's injective. So you can really use it. And so it's injective, so this is bigger than the integral when you perform the change of variable. Now, you use the fact that theta of y was exactly of this form, so you know how to estimate from below the supremum, because by construction you have a decomposition of theta of y, and so this is bigger than this, and now the terms in Ci can be put together, and what you get is exactly the Monge-Ampère type equation, I mean the term in the Monge-Ampère equation on the second line of the slide. So this rearranged, and you get the Brass-Kemp-Leib type term. Okay. So this somehow completes. No, I have some more slides. So this completes the proof of the lemma. And So in spirit, although I wrote the lemma with arbitrary Fi and capital F, in spirit, what you do is really you would interpolate between Fi and the Gaussian for which you think that they are optimal, and then when you do so, you don't lose. Okay. I have. So this last minute, I will just dedicate to a few more remarks on somehow the to emphasize the fact that transportation is a rather flexible tool. So transportation on manifolds is oh. It's not very clean, sorry. So optimal transportation on manifolds exists, and this was done by McCann, and this helped a lot, of course, in proving an analog of the Prekopa-Lendler inequality on manifolds. So this is due to Cordero, McCann, and Schmuck and Schlegel. And when you think of it, I mean, on manifolds, it would be very difficult to apply rearrangement methods. I mean, apart from the case of the sphere and the hyperbolic space, maybe. And the last remark is about this talk. I mean, with the same title and the same structure, I could have talked about something completely different, which is Sharpe-Sobolev inequalities, where rearrangement and very recently transportation turn out to be very efficient. So the Sharpe-Sobolev inequalities were derived by Aubin and Talenti. I mean, apart from the case P equal 1 that goes back to Federer and Mazilla, I guess. And, okay, so rearrangement is crucial there because somehow rearranging the function decreases its energy. Okay, so if P is bigger than 1, then the LP norm of the rearranged gradient is smaller. And then you reduce the problem to some optimization problem in one variable, and I think it turned out to be already solved by the time. Okay. And so it was very surprising that transportation may also be applied in this case. So for P equal 1, this was done by Gromov and was somehow forgotten. And it was recently understood that the transportation method also apply in this case. Okay. So I hope that this gives you a nice overview of these tools. Thank you for your attention. Doesn't work?